2 degrees in Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Before we get to today's morning show, we want to remind you that the morning show is available as a podcast. And when you subscribe to the morning show podcast, that means you get to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. And often over the weekend, the podcast version of the morning show features real gems from morning shows in the distant past out of the archives. If you're interested in subscribing to the Morning Show podcast, you need to be sure to look for the right title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available through all of the major podcast providers, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll consider subscribing to The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the 28th of February, the last day of Black History Month, and I'm very excited about the interview which I'm about to share with you from the Morning Show archives. Over this past New Year's, my wife and I had the pleasure of traveling down to Little Rock, Arkansas, for the wedding of a former voice student of mine. And while we were there, we made a point of visiting Central High School and the adjoining National Park Visitor Center that tells the story of the so-called Little Rock Nine, nine African-American young people who were chosen to help integrate the otherwise all-white Central High School back in 1957. It was an incredibly dramatic scene that not only captivated the nation, but captured the attention of people all around the world. Melba Petillo Beals was one of those nine young people. And several years ago, I had the tremendous pleasure and honor of interviewing her for the morning show. Melba Petillo Beals went on not only to college, but to teach at the collegiate level. For a number of years, she taught journalism at Dominican University of California. And she has written several books stemming from her life experience, including Warriors Don't Cry, White is a State of Mind, and I Will Not Fear, My Story of a Lifetime of Building Faith Over Fear. The book that we talk about in this particular interview was a book written with young people, young readers in mind, a book titled March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine. Here is my conversation with Melba Petillo Beals. Melba Petillo Beals, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It is my blessing. Please call me Melba.
I will do that, and thank you again for making time for this. I have to say, before we start talking about the book itself, that I just read that you were born on December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So
I was. Some of us have traumatic lives. I've had quite a traumatic life.
I guess so. So you were born on a day when history changed, and of course you were part of yet another very significant day when history changed.
Right, and if you look at the pattern of my life, it's pretty much matched that. You know.
I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of writing about your life and the difficulties of your childhood and what it was like to live in Little Rock, Arkansas, in a time when bigotry was so rampant, what it was like to write about that with young people in mind, young readers in mind. What did you think about in terms of deciding how to do that?
You have to have a goal, first of all. I think I'm a mom. I'm a twice mom. I've just finished my second generations of children. I adopted a set when I was 50. And so you have to know children, I think. I've been a teacher, both in the earliest and the latest of grades. And so I have familiarity with children and how they perceive. So I had some experience. And my goal, you have to have a goal. My goal was to not preach, but to show people, this is what it's like when you oppress. Do keep this in mind. It is such a painful experience for the target of your expression, your oppression, that you need to know what you're doing in somebody's life when you do that to them. Mm-hmm. You need to know the constancy of the misery, the anticipation that that person must develop. And, you know, just look at this and see if you can get into some of these feelings, and maybe you won't do it. Yeah. Mm.
And, of course, the challenge is to write that, in this particular case, for young people to try to understand a world quite different, if not completely different, from the world in which they themselves live. I think
it's really simplistic. You have to really be simple and not leave anything out. Because young people observe what we as adults take for granted.
Mm. You tell us...
For example, I talk about that the first time I really knew that we lived someplace odd, I was 3 years old. And what I noticed was not necessarily what one might think. I noticed how my parents' expression, behavior had changed when we left home and went into public. We went to the grocery store, which was a couple blocks away. They would kowtow, curtsy, bow, let white people get in line in front of them. And, you know, little kids know it's not your turn. It's my turn to be in line, and you're going to jump in front of me for no reason? Well, I want to go home and play with my toys. I don't want to be in the grocery store, and therefore I'm not happy about it.
I
think people get that point, you know.
Absolutely. I was surprised to read in the very first chapter of the book, so this is when you are still quite young, and you are already starting to notice some of these indignities suffered by you and your parents and so on. You write, "I imagined there must be places beyond Arkansas where my folks were treated better." Now, this is before there was any television in your home, because you tell us some years later when you finally got television and you saw once in a while certain famous African-Americans on television being treated very respectfully, and that was certainly a clear indication that somewhere out there black people were treated kindly and with respect. But at a young age, you had a sense that that might be true.
Yeah, but it was based on the fact that I had two uncles. Two dapper uncles that used to come down from Michigan all the time. They'd come down every couple months. And, I had relatives that lived outside that boundary, and they'd come down there, and they would immediately get in trouble. But their visiting was significant because they would hold me on their lap and talk to me, and they'd say to me, you know, you should come back home with me. Because at home, if you come back, you could do so many things that you can't do here.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there was a reason. And just in my, I can't tell you this, but just in my heart and in my soul, for example, the one thing I've always thought since the beginning of my life is I want to live at the edge. And I used to go back and tell my grandmother, I'm going to live at the edge. And my grandmother said, what do you mean by the edge? And I said, at the edge of the earth.
Hmm. Where things would be better.
No, in this case, I just thought that I could breathe better. Mm. I had really, really bad asthma. And I could envision a place like California where there was an ocean just beyond. And I could breathe better if there was water.
We're speaking with Melba Patillo-Beals, and her book, March Forward Girl, tells her about her experience of growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and ultimately of being one of the so-called Little Rock Nine who were brought in to integrate Central High School. You have very, very warm feelings, I'm sure, to this very day for your grandma, who you call at one point your very best friend. I could ask you about so many things you tell us about, but I want to have you describe to our listeners something that you call garden time with your grandma. Explain what garden time was all about and what a difference it made for you as a youngster.
Well, she always had a garden. And so every day at watering time and gardening time, I'd go with her. And I'd stand beside her and hold on to her dress while she was watering. Sometimes I'd get very wet. And she would talk to me about anything I wanted to talk about. It was my turn. So she would say, now, what is happening to you today? What's in your mind? What do you wonder about? What do you want to talk about? Do you have any questions for me? And I always did. Hmm. Why are the men so big? And why do they get to be those people? And
yeah, well, who writes these rules that makes white people feel like they're better than everybody else? I wonder if you could talk about those experiences you had in your life when you would be overtaken by what you called my Little Rock feelings. Those were the feelings of fear, of just like something in your gut, a knot in the stomach. And this would not be at home, and this wouldn't be at church, but this would be when you were out and about, for instance, at the grocery store. You hated going to the grocery store. Explain what going to the grocery store was like and what made it so hurtful for you.
Well, little kids want to do what? They want to touch everything. So the rule in the grocery store was black people couldn't touch anything because they said if we touched it, nobody would want to buy it, right? Mm. We'd make it all tainted and stinky. Well, what do you mean, stinky? I take baths every night.
If a black person touched anything on the shelves, then a white person coming along behind them wouldn't want to purchase
right.
that. So you were forbidden from touching anything at all.
What are we going to do about this? But it was just so hard to think that when I got into public, I had to stand a certain way, stand in a certain place, usually wait for somebody to come along. But if that didn't happen, we would plan on burning a whole day.
Hmm. Explain the so-called rules of survival, which you were told about by your grandmother and your mother and father, for that matter. What were those rules of survival, and what were the ones that were hardest for you to follow as a youngster?
Well, okay, so don't look a white person in the face. We know that Emmett Till got killed for that one. If somebody's coming down the sidewalk and you're walking up the sidewalk, you step off into the mud. No matter the gender or age or anything, this person, it's you do it. If someone is studying a library, you open it up and sell it.
Hmm. You tell us that church was one place where you felt, at least for the most part, very, very safe. That was a place of community, of fellowship, and a place where the fears that you felt in a place like the grocery store or the department store were just not a part of the proceedings. You experienced...
No, you step inside of there, and the most important thing you felt at church in the beginning was safety. Nobody's going to hit me. Nobody's going to call me a nigger. It's going to be so great. My parents are going to smile. They're going to get that your frank smile off their face, and they're going to get the real smile. And it's going to be so nice there, you know.
There is something truly terrifying and horrifying that you witness, I believe not in your own church. I believe it was in another church where you actually witnessed someone from the Ku Klux Klan invading that space, that holy space, in a way that had to be truly sickening for you, especially when one thinks about if church for you was a place of sanctuary, in the truest sense of the word, nothing could have been more terrible than to have that sense of sanctuary shattered. Did church?
Well, isn't God somebody to each and every one of us? No matter who we are, God is somebody, and God was the church, according to Grandma, and everybody in my family. And so, therefore, if there was a absolutely one inch of anything, the happiness of it all would be shown to you at church. That's how I felt. But eventually I had to understand that that wasn't, if it had been used, abused.
You tell us about those moments when you would have glimmers of hope, such as when your grandma told you about a baseball player by the name of Jackie Robinson, and you remember listening to him on the radio and feeling some sense of hope. Something else that gave you a tremendous sense of hope was when you and your family visited St. Louis, Missouri. Say a quick word about why that trip was such a dramatic one for you, and why it was hard to return to Little Rock.
Yeah, by this time I was a young teenager. And I got to experience what I had envisioned. There was the city where white folks didn't just call you a nigger on the street. You could walk into a store and touch the merchandise. I mean, it was so fabulous. There were, just what was out, the groceries and stuff. You could touch anything you wanted. I mean, it was beyond my comprehension.
And, of course, you write about how it made it even worse when you got back on that train, a segregated train, and returned to Little Rock and returned to that life where life meant so many indignities on a daily basis.
Unbelievable. And in the church, I witnessed a man be hanged. So now you've taken away the only sanctuary I have in my life. If you're riding a bus, you're vulnerable. No matter where you were, you were vulnerable now. Mm. And church wasn't an exception. And that really worried me.
Right. Your book is a book that tells us a lot about what life was like for your family and families like your family in a place like Little Rock, Arkansas. But it also, along with an unsparing portrayal of what the frustrations were of life, there were also these moments when there was hope, when once in a while you would experience kindness from a white person, or when you would receive a certain gift that might be important to you, like a gift that was given to you on your birthday in 1950, a gift from your grandma of a globe. Why do you think that globe was so extraordinarily important to you at that point?
Well, there before me was the world. There before me was a place where the Klan did not ride every afternoon at dusk. There before me were all the places I dreamed about. California that I'd seen in the 17 magazine. Things I'd seen mentioned, you know. To me, one of the most precious things in my life was magazines. Because they gave me pictures once we could get a hold of when I was a little older. They gave me pictures of what was beyond my border. Mm. I was a happy girl. Somebody came over with an old magazine. Ooh, it was precious. I preserved it for years.
Wow. You eventually come to have a more sophisticated understanding of what these Jim Crow laws were all about.
I was steaming when someone taught me as I got older that there's actually written on paper a set of laws that pertain to this. This is not just accidental, you know?
Well, and it also was a moment when you realized that these white people, they themselves were not, in a sense, breaking the law or, in their eyes, doing anything wrong when they were doing these things. They were following the law, a terrible, evil law that was in place. And, of course, that had to change everything about the way that you felt.
And to learn that there was something that granted white people permission to treat me like doggy do was startling, because then I know that I'm doomed. Who's going to go in there and collect those people? They can treat me any way they want if they're alone. There'll be witnesses.
And then in 1954, there is the beginning of a dramatic change with the Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education saying that, in fact, separate was not equal, and ordering the integration of schools, a move which was met with immense anger and resistance by most of the white community of Little Rock, including the school board.
On that day, that very day, I literally almost got raped by a man who said, "Give you niggas an inch, you take a mile. Now you think you're going to school with my babies. You're not doing that."
Tell our listeners about how you, in effect, accidentally volunteered to perhaps be considered to be one of the first black students to help integrate Central High. Explain what your teacher asked in the schoolroom that morning.
She walked through the classroom and said, "Will those who live in the district of Central High School raise your hand?" And I did. And then she said, "Okay. Will those who want to go to Central High School raise their hand?" Well, I did. Not everybody did. I did. And then she said, "Well, I have this sheet of paper you can sign. You need to give it to your parents for a signature. In compliance with the 1954 Brown decision, there will begin integration in these schools next September."
And ultimately, you were one of the nine who were selected to walk through that door of Central High School. What were the things that they were looking for in terms of carefully choosing those first nine students who would integrate Central High School? What were they looking for?
They sifted the school, and they began that sift by saying those who were did not have behavior problems, those who had good grades, those who had attitude of respect for older people, and those who were clean in their dress and their presentation. Those were the basics.
As you approach Central High School that first day, accompanied by Little Rock, no, I think the first day, were you accompanied by anybody at all aside from your mother?
You know, the head of the local NAACP, they sort of dropped us off. In my case, I was accompanied by my mom because we were late and got separated from the others. And there was really no formal plan. I mean, the problem with that first day was we lacked a systemic plan, because who the heck thought we'd be in that much trouble? The woman who was head of the NAACP said, "Well, you know, we'll meet on a certain corner," and we did. We were supposed to, you know. Now imagine that the expanse of this school is from 14th to 16th Street. It's eight blocks in diameter. Two across, two down, two across the back, and two up the side. So it's a big place. It's not a small place. And so we were supposed to meet on the corner of, like, I think, 14th Street. And so there we were, my mother and I. We get there, this huge crowd. It's like going to the rodeo. You know, we thought, well, what's happening? Maybe Johnny Mathis or somebody really special has come to see the day, the opening day of school.
If only.
If only.
Yes.
And we thought, well, it sounds like a football game. You know how when you come into a football game, all the yelling and screaming. And at first you can't distinguish the words.
Right.
You just hear the yelling.
Right.
And it takes a moment for the yelling to turn into words. And there's excitement because, first of all the people are white. So it takes your mind. See, you don't really quickly discern the amount of trouble you're totally in. It takes a while for it to, wait a minute. These are white people. No black people are in here yelling and screaming like this. Why are they yelling and screaming, and what are they looking across the street at? Well, they were looking at one of our number, Elizabeth Beckford, walk a gauntlet in front of the school.
Right.
They were looking at her being escorted by a ugly group of white people who would call her every name in the book and tell her she wasn't worth anything.
Well, ultimately, this mob, of course, turns you away. You return the next day with police, and eventually, you have to be escorted into school with soldiers. I mean, one can hardly imagine what that was like. Have you ever stopped to think about how much your experience was a little bit like that of Jackie Robinson and what he faced when he first entered Major League Baseball?
Absolutely. But in some ways, we were children. And so somehow in my mind, I thought adults don't hurt children. You know, I'm 15 years of age. So you don't envision, at 14 and 15, I didn't envision death. I didn't envision adults would misbehave that way. I didn't envision, you know, I had to trust God from the beginning. They've been holding meetings in the white community and the black community. And in my community, my grandmother always talked to us about how we're going to get through this is we're going to trust God.
Hmm.
You know, you're not getting through this because you smell great. You get through it because in your soul there must be a belief that you're doing the right thing.
As I was reading your book, I was realizing that the news cameras only captured that ugly scene outside of Central High School as the Arkansas 9, Little Rock 9, walked up to that front door with that mob of protesters there hurling insults and so on. But cameras never showed, as far as I know at least, anything once you entered the building and what daily life was like.
At one point, one of the New York Times reporters and the Life reporters infiltrated. They were tiny people, ladies, and they came in and acted as students.
Wow.
So, but no, there was no shooting on the inside.
Right. So you're one of the only people, you and your counterparts, are the only ones, in a sense, who can really say much about what day-to-day life was like. How did the experience in Central High School as a student in this otherwise all-white school compared to other incidents that you had experienced earlier in your life, experiences that brought you fear and discomfort? Was this about the same, much, much worse, not quite as bad?
No. It was the most astounding, overwhelming experience in my life, still today, and I'm 76. The change from being a fairly calm, fairly settled, safe teenager in your home, as safe as you can be, to being in this environment. It was like going to war. It was like, no, wait a minute. These people really won't kill me to keep from going to school. Then, oh, yeah, they will. They killed somebody last night. They're not practicing rope making for nothing. They'll get you, kiddo. And then what will you do?
Wow. What kind of response did you have from the teachers there versus the white students? By and large, did the teachers seem willing to teach you, albeit perhaps grudgingly?
Some of them grudgingly, some of them quite willing and helpful. If they got too friendly, they got castigated.
By some of their colleagues.
One boy screamed out loud to my English teacher at one point, you're a nigger lover, you wait.
Wow. What kind of difference did any of the white students make in terms of the, granted, I'm sure, relatively few who were not quite so openly hostile? I mean, were there kindnesses shown to you? And through the course of the year, did that situation in any significant way improve?
Well, I would say not a lot. It improved probably 15-20%, but not because people were more willing to allow us in, but because the army, the local army's routine was much like that of the norm, and they were into a lot of events. For example, they were just into the transition part of it, you know. And so near the end of the school, soldiers had been were left, and we were there by ourselves. And on the last 2 days of school, the vice principal, Ms. Huckabee, offered to keep all of us like there.
Mm. At some point, you made mention of a bodyguard. Did you always have a bodyguard with you in school?
Always, always, and but not till the end. As long as the soldiers were in town.
So it was either soldiers on duty or a bodyguard assigned to you to try
No, there was no bodyguard assigned. It was while the soldiers were in town, the bodyguard were the soldiers.
I see. So when the soldiers left, there was no bodyguard.
Goodbye.
Wow. What kind of learning were you able to do through the course of that year? That is...
Well, you know, not much, but I kept my grades up. Not as good as they had been. I kept them up, however, because in my household, there's no coming home with low grades.
Right. But I was just thinking how mentally and emotionally it was such a difficult experience, such a difficult scenario in which to be able to concentrate and focus. I'm sure it had to be a really, really difficult challenge in that respect.
Well, it was one that you couldn't always discern. Like, what's going to happen to me today? How's that going down? And how can I respond in a way that will save my life? And you get more bold as the time proceeds. I got more bold, you know.
Really?
Yeah, because, for example, at the dark end of the school, these boys trapped me, and this one boy is standing up against me, pushing me against the cabinets, and I figure out he's going to kill me. The only way I'm getting out is reaching for his testicles, and I did. You got to protect yourself. You know, in the end, also, my soldier taught me about self-protection. He said, you got to do what you got to do till you can get to safety, you know.
Mm. How difficult was it to resist the urge to fight back in a way that might have led to your being expelled, as happened to one of the nine? I mean, was it difficult for you to, in a sense, toe the line and tolerate this kind of treatment, or were you bound and determined to do so one way or another?
We all had to follow the prescribed treatment, because what good would it have done to spend all that time tortured and mistreated and then blow it? So we really did, and it was interesting. Dr. Martin Luther King came down to visit us a couple of times, and he was really clear on saying, you set your goals in life, and that's what you work for.
Mm. You did make it through the year, but of course, in that following summer, there was a very, very frightening development with the local Ku Klux Klan that you tell us about in your book. Explain the kind of dire danger that you and the other nine suddenly found yourself in.
The whole situation of going to school with no guards was incredible. And at one point, the vice principal hit us in her office. Is that what you mean? The transitioning out was difficult.
Right.
Because by the end of the year, they were determined we were not going to go back. And the governor was absolutely determined we were not going to go back. So it was a very ugly scene. And we felt as though we had very little shield between us and those hooligans who would do bad.
Right. And who wanted to see you apprehended, perhaps even killed. Your parents...
Well, yeah, they threatened to have us beaten. And, you know, they knew the jail terms. They said, we can get up, you can't. Meant, you know, girls. It was an ugly, ugly road, pedal to the metal scene where
right.
You had to pray, you had to go rare, prayed up, and when something awful happened, you had to turn inward for your support.
Right.
There was no adult within the limits of that school that was going to help you, not really.
Hmm. Ultimately, your parents made what I'm sure was a difficult decision and yet a necessary decision to have you go off to actually Santa Rosa, California to complete your high school.
Yes, because I write that I had a relative who was in the Klan. Like all black families, we were a mixed black family. And he was passing the numbers, and so he called up to say, Mother Lois, how great that was. And we said, look, what's up? And he said, you're going to be killed. So we said, you know, it's up to you to attend the Klan meeting and find out what they got in store for us.
Wow. So your parents sent you off to Santa Rosa, California, and you finished your high school education there. And actually, you write in your book about actually the extraordinary experience you had about living with this family called the McCabes. Just say a word about how transformative this time was in Santa Rosa, California, and what kind of difference it made for the life that you've lived since.
Well, I landed there in great fear. See, I didn't know till I got to the airport. Or I didn't know till I got to the San Francisco airport that I was going to go live with a white family. I thought it was a black family. Nobody said that to me. And my mother really didn't know that it was a white family. And so I was just stiff with fear. But they said, come on, go home, go over. And I got into the van and we went home. And it was a very difficult time to see life implode on the gentleman who guaranteed to get us out.
Well, you end up experiencing life as you had never experienced it before in a place where, at least for the most part, you were not the target of bigotry and discrimination as you had been.
Well, the goal was, of course, to end up in Santa Rosa. But, for example, even in Santa Rosa, there was some racism. Papa took me to swim in the pool. And they wouldn't let me swim in the pool, so Daddy made these placards and marched up and down. There was no racism in the school, however. I never once in Montgomery High School felt anything but, you know, curiosity. That love is the answer, and that not all white people were involved in this. Some of them did step up to the plate. The ministers, the Christians, stepped up to save our lives. I wouldn't be here if they didn't.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and I'm so glad you tell it as well as you do in this book, March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine, published by HMH Books for Young Readers. I'm sure many young people will read this and be fascinated and inspired by your story, as I was. Melba Patilla-Beals, thank you so much, and very best wishes, and thank you for being part of The Morning Show today. I was honored to speak with you.
My honor, my pleasure, my blessing. God bless.
Thank you. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The interview for part two is one from the archives recorded back in August of 2020. And it is a privilege indeed for me to be reconnecting with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham, with whom I've had the special pleasure of speaking on several different occasions and even once in person when he visited Carthage College. His most recent book could not be more timely. His Truth is Marching On, John Lewis and the Power of Hope, published by Random House. And we are recording this interview as I am sitting in a radio studio in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which has just experienced two nights of demonstrations and riots in the wake of yet another dramatic and controversial police shooting. So I appreciate being able to have a few minutes with John Meacham at this moment in time. John Meacham, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much, and we're thinking about you and hope that resolution comes.
Well, hope is one of the words in the subtitle of this book about John Lewis. And of course, it is a reminder of something President Obama said during the Democratic National Convention, which is, if anybody had reason to give up hope and to become cynical and hopeless, it would be those who were engaged in some of the most difficult moments of the civil rights movement. Tell us what you saw in John Lewis that allowed him to have sustained hope through so many incredibly difficult years.
He believed in a way that so few of us can, that the world could be brought closer into tune with America's professed ideals and also with the implications of the biblical and moral teachings of a beloved community, based on the notion that we should, in fact, attempt to love our neighbor as ourselves. And from his earliest hours in Pike County, Alabama, he was the great-grandson of an enslaved person. He was the son of sharecroppers. He was a figure who came of age in a segregated universe. He had an intuitive moral revulsion to the segregated apartheid-like order of my native region. And because of his church, because of the gospel that he heard, the prayers that he prayed, he saw that faith in a greater order should not simply be about a better life beyond time, but the tributary of his revulsion at segregation and the belief, perennial, persistent belief, that the gospel spoke to us not simply beyond time, but in time, led him to see that he was called, and I use that word advisedly, he was called, summoned by history to put the biblical injunctions into action. Words became deeds. And he believed he was living out his life according to a divine purpose. And that may grate on modern ears. It grated on modern ears then, right? There was a great division in the civil rights movement between the Sunday school folks like King and Lewis and the more secular folks who became even more insistent on systemic change. So this was not smooth sailing either internally within the movement or externally as the movement took its case to the people, took the cases to the people, because there was more than one. But as Bernard Lafayette, his college roommate in Nashville, said, John was never going to give up. And it was something of a miracle that John Lewis survived those years because he always led with his head and he never raised a fist.
At one point in your book, you say that John Lewis was as important to the founding of a modern and multi-ethnic 20th and 21st century America as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Samuel Adams were to the initial creation of the Republic itself in the 18th century. What leads you to say that?
Because the country we're living in, the country that faced the election in 16, the country that faces the election in 70 days or so, is a pluralistic, multi-ethnic nation of changing demography. And for all of its limitations, it has the widest possible participation by the largest number of people. And that was not true before 1965. 100 years after Appomattox, there was functional apartheid in this country. We continued to live under an immigration system that had been established in the 1920s, that established national quotas, was very much biased toward European nations. And in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act, in 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, and with President Johnson's Immigration and Nationality Act, which is a piece of great society legislation that doesn't get enough attention, it fundamentally changed the infrastructure the infrastructure of identity in this country. In many ways, I would argue that the country you and I know, the country you and I live in, is really only 55 years old, because before 1965, it was still a country that enforced in law white supremacy. And what John Lewis insisted on, what Ella Baker insisted on, what Diane Nash insisted upon, what Dr. King insisted upon, what Stokely Carmichael insisted upon, was no, that America was not supposed to be a project of exclusion, but a project in universal liberty. And however imperfectly we've realized the implications of that argument, this electorate in 2020 is radically different, and I would argue better, than it was 55 years ago. And John Lewis was the Paul Revere of that, right? He was a foot soldier and a field commander and really a second or even third American Revolution. If you consider the first revolution to be in the late 18th century, the second to be the Civil War, really the third was the work of the 1950s and 1960s to open the doors. What we are seeing, not least in your backyard, is how incompletely we have realized what we have to do. But we are in a better place, however imperfect this place is, because of the courage of people like John Lewis.
A last question. Explain to our listeners how well you knew John Lewis and the circumstances under which you were able to speak with him over the years.
30 years ago, 28 years ago, I was a baby reporter for the Chattanooga Times, my hometown newspaper. I was covering Georgia politics. We were right across the state line, and I met him on an election night in 1992. One of the things about election nights is if you're a politician, the measure of your power is how little you are seen, because people expect you to be in sort of like a priest-like way off, you know, doing important things. John and Lillian, his wife, were in the ballroom with everybody all night, just sitting and standing there. And I walked up and was tremulous, I will confess, because his historic role was already clear, and started up a conversation. And I was incredibly blessed, as were thousands of other people, to spend time with him through the decades. We spent time in Nashville and Sewanee, Tennessee, and Atlanta and Washington and New York. We talked a lot through the years, usually after a big news event, after Katrina, say, when he was talking about the role, what we had to do about poverty, or for one of the many commemorations. John always believed in the power of story. He believed in these anniversaries not to celebrate what had happened, but to reaffirm what has to happen. And when he was diagnosed with the pancreatic cancer that ultimately killed him, I wanted to have a kind of final round of conversations for a project like this. And then when I was honored to be with my family and a lot of other folks on the Pettus Bridge with him in March, it just occurred to me that this was the time, that his exemplary life has so much to teach us, that it's a story that we can't tell enough.
The book again is titled His Truth is Marching On, John Lewis and the Power of Hope, published by Random House, the author John Meacham. John Meacham, thank you for giving the world this important book, and thank you for being part of the morning show once again.
Thank you. Take good care out there.